Hey, it's Francis. This week, it's an encore of our conversation with one of the great legends of cuisine. Actually, two of them. It's our discussion with the great Claudia Rodin and with one of her biggest fans, Yotam Ottolenghi. Check it out. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, you know the old cliche about how you can tell a lot about a person by the company they keep? Well, when you ascend to a certain stratosphere of legendariness, you can tell a lot about a person by the people who credit them for, well, pretty much everything. This week, we're talking to Claudia Rodin, the Egyptian-British food writer who started her publishing career over 50 years ago with a landmark tome with an unassuming title, A Book of Middle Eastern Food. Well, that unassuming-sounding book introduced pretty much all of the Middle Eastern favorites you know, and way more, to the West. The writer Jane Kramer says Claudia is one of three people who changed how Britain and the English-speaking world ate in the post-war years. Nigella Lawson says no book will ever take the place of Claudia's Book of Jewish Food in her heart. And our first guest to introduce us to the glories of Claudia Rodin is Yotam Ottolenghi, one of her biggest fans. Yotam, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Francis. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, so let's play a little imagination game. I am putting together the Hall of Fame of food literature, and you get to give the inductee speech for Claudia Rodin. This is happening in 5 minutes because I'm the world's worst party planner. What are you going to go up there and say?
Yeah. Well, I've done that before, I have to say. So on a couple of occasions, because I consider myself to be, or some people would consider me to be a kind of a Claudia protege, or someone who's kind of grown up under her wings in some shape or form. Because ever since I started cooking, Claudia has been an immense influence over my food, or more, not so much, maybe less of an influence over the food, but an influence over the food writing and the scholarly approach to food. So this is the approach that I'm going to take. And I'm going to say that Claudia Rodin has published many cookbooks, and I have published many cookbooks. They couldn't be any more different from each other. So Claudia Rodin's books include recipes, but it's really her scholarly abilities, her knowledge, her ability to get into the real details of the history, the background of a dish, and the general story of a cuisine that earns her a place high up in the Hall of Fame of food, because she really is the most incredible food historian with a capital H, with a small H. You know, she really does the legwork, but she's also a big historian in the sense that she's got the bigger picture in mind when she writes down recipes. And she's covered so many cuisines, you know, the whole of the Middle East, if that's even possible, in North Africa. In real great details, Spain, Italy, incredible.
Yeah. You had this really wonderful quote that you wrote about her. I'll just read it. You said, you know, she has the sense of the deep relatedness of food to big history as well as to little stories is precisely what's so great about Claudia's writing. And so when you talk about her as an historian, and I think that is definitely her reputation, if you go into reading her work, I think you might be surprised at how personal and intimate the writing can also be. Talk about that a little bit.
I think what I was aiming to say is that when I hear someone telling me a book about the history of food, I'm going there in a particular state of mind. You know, I think it could be very interesting. But in a way, I'm looking for an academic approach. You know, there's this and that and that I'm going to cover. With Claudia's attitude, it's a much different approach. And it comes from how she got started, because Claudia started her family had to immigrate from Egypt to Britain in the 1950s. They essentially escaped from Alexandria in Egypt and settled in North London. And she just started collecting recipes from friends and families from all over the world, Jewish immigrants in London of the 50s and 60s. So her attitude, her approach comes from cooking with people and hearing their stories, not as a historian, as an academic historian who kind of approaches the subject from above. She starts from the bottom down, you know, from cooking, from talking to people, from chronicling personal stories. And I find that is very, very special.
Yeah. And she truly loves to cook, too. It's not just, oh, this was, you know, what piqued my intellectual interest. I think she really has, you know, extraordinary pleasure in cooking and sharing. What are recipes of hers that you've loved making or that you remember making?
So I've loved her rice recipes, and I'm obsessed with rice and the way it's cooked around the Middle East. So, you know, like Persians at a way of, you know, of parboiling and then cooking the rice could kind of steam itself in a pot. I've got a recipe that I published in Plenty More in my third book or fourth book, in which it's got saffron and dates and almonds, and it's really inspired by a dish of hers that I've found in one of her books. So I love her rice dishes. You know, whenever ever I need the ultimate information about a particular Jewish recipe that I don't know, I go to Claudia's book. This is where I get the real deal when it comes. You know, if I need to make gefilte fish, because I didn't grow up in a house with gefilte fish, I would go to Claudia for the recipe and the story. It's incredible. She's got incredible references, all really deeply rooted in personal stories, which is just so fun to read.
Yeah, totally. Lord, it seems to me that, you know, your name and the Ottolenghi restaurants have been around forever, but they've been around for 15, 20 years?
Mm-hmm. That's just about right, yeah.
Yeah, and so, first of all, congratulations on that. That's amazing. but if you think back to when you started with your cafes and these beautiful displays of vegetable dishes and using so many of the flavors that, you know, you've become known for, the sumac and pomegranate molasses and things like that. Even that time ago, 15, 20 years ago, I think when I first started reading about your restaurants and your food, it was, oh my God, Yotam Ottolenghi is introducing London to all of these Middle Eastern flavors, all these Israeli flavors. You know, they're so exciting to us. But if you go back further in time to when Claudia published a book of Middle Eastern food in 1968, I believe, and what the understanding of this cuisine was at that time, talk a little bit about the evolution you've seen in like the English speaking world's understanding of these traditions, and so, and then bring us back to what she must have been publishing into.
Yeah, it's. I'm really glad you asked me this question because, Francis, you know, I've been given all sorts of accolades and descriptions that I've been very shy to accept. And one of them is the person who's introduced Middle Eastern ingredients to English-speaking or Western audiences. And I always tell them, first of all, I've got nothing to do with it. These traditions have been around for a very long time. But even in the field of publishing, Claudia Roden published the book of Middle Eastern food that you mentioned in 1968. That was the year I was born. I'll reveal my old age. And that book really has everything. It really, really does have everything. It does have the za'atar and the pomegranate molasses and the rose water and the aubergines and the tahini and, you know, all the ingredients that I love cooking. And when I open this book and I flick through it, and I brought it off the shelf for our conversation. It's here in front of me. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've introduced anything new to the vocabulary. It's, I mean, Claudia quite sincerely has done it all, has had it all there. I think maybe if Sami Tamimi and I, Sami is my business and writing partner for a very long time, have done anything, was just to put it in a slightly more up-to-date context, you know, to modernize it in a particular way or make it palatable for a particular audience and maybe just, you know. But many of our classic dishes are really rooted very deeply in places that Claudia has covered, you know, many, many years earlier. So I always say, before us, there were many other people amongst them, or at the top is Claudia Roden, just because she has really made an incredible foray into Middle Eastern cooking.
Do you have any more dishes of hers? Because like she has written so many, I mean, a book of Middle Eastern food, I've never counted, but I mean, there are probably 200 recipes in there, I would guess. And she's written 18 books besides. If we were just getting started cooking in her canon, what are dishes do you recall that we should try?
So she's got, you know, Clonia has got everything. She will give you a great recipe for hummus in one tradition or another tradition, or eggplant salads, you know, from the baba ganoush and with tahini, with olive oil, with etc. That she will really offer the whole range of Middle Eastern cooking that that you would expect to find. One cake that she's introduced and has become really popular the world over is her boiled orange cake. I don't know if it has made as much impact in North America as it has done in the UK, but there used to be a time, I don't know how long ago, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, that every cafe that you went into at a restaurant has made this a version of this cake. And essentially, it's a whole boiled orange that's cooked in boiling water for a good hour or so, or a very long time, until it goes completely soft. And then it splits down to puree. And then you add sugar, ground almonds to it, eggs, and it turns into the most moist cake you can ever imagine.
Oh my God, that sounds incredible.
And it includes the whole orange. And there was a time where you could even find it in Pret a Manger, the chain of sandwiches that is you can find on every British high street, via Nigella Lawson, because Nigella published the recipe based on Claudia's cake, and then that got to Pret a Manger. But really, Claudia is the one who's introduced that wonderful cake, which has all the wonderful essences, you know, aromas of the Middle East, that kind of intense orange flavor, which comes from mostly from, I would say it comes from the region of greater Syria, the Levant.
Yeah. Oh my God, I have to make that now. I'd heard about the orange cake, her famous orange cake, but I didn't realize it was made in such a cool technique. I've never made anything like that before.
Yeah, this is a really cool technique, and to boil the whole orange and then to use the skin, the seeds, the flesh, everything together, and the result is incredible. And I challenge the listeners to extend this and use it in sauces for like vinaigrettes for salads and things like that. I've tried and did over the years, but the technique itself of boiling a whole orange, I've learned from Claudia. And ever since, you know, I've done that with a lemon since then, to kind of make a kind of something that is much quicker than preserved lemon paste, but has similar qualities. Mm-hmm. And it's a great way to use an orange or a lemon, and it's no effort at all.
That's fabulous. All right, Yotam, thank you so much. I'm so excited to get into it with Claudia herself.
Thank you, Francis.
That's Yotam Ottolenghi, author of many cookbooks, probably some of your favorites, including his most recent, Flavor, written with Ista Belfridge. You can find his recipe for saffron, date, and almond rice from his book Plenty More at splendidtable.org. Coming up...
When I had become a food writer, at the time when my children left home, which I was still young, in my 40s, I decided that the day they leave, I will leave as well. And I went not knowing what I would find. I just decided that I won't waste a minute. I will ask every single person that I meet, what is their favorite recipe?
It's the woman of the hour, the legendary Claudia Rodin. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. This week, we're all about the Egyptian-British food writer Claudia Rodin, who's done more to introduce the foods of the Middle East and Mediterranean to the English-speaking world than just about anyone on Earth. I'm so excited to talk with her today. She's joining us from her home in London. So, hi, Claudia. It's so good to have you.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm honored to be here.
Oh my goodness, it's the honor is ours. It's a cliche, but it's true. Okay, so I knew that when I'd have a chance to talk with you, that I wanted to ask you about your research process, how you gathered recipes and stories for your many books, and Then lo and behold, I'm reading the introduction to your newest book, Claudia Roden's Mediterranean, and you start the book by writing pretty much exactly about that. And it sounds like that process basically starts with you traveling, walking around, and just asking people what their favorite dishes are. How did you make that work?
Well, I started doing that many years ago. Well, when I first started collecting recipes, which was in 1956, when I was 20 years old. And it was when the Jews were leaving Egypt in a hurry after the Suez War. They were forced to leave. And within a couple of weeks, they were out. And I was in London as an art student. Suddenly, my parents arrived and hundreds of relatives and friends who went all over the world where they were able to go. And so for several years, maybe 10 years, I was living in this bubble of refugees who were in a bit of a trauma. And one thing that they were doing was exchanging recipes, saying, I'll never see you again, but if you give me this orange cake, it'll be something to remember you by. So I felt at that time that it was the most important thing I could do was to write down recipes, their recipes, because there hadn't been a single cookbook in Egypt of any kind. There were no recipes in magazines. Nobody trusted the printed recipe. The recipes were only handed down in families. And so I thought, we'll lose all these recipes. And there were recipes not just from Egypt, as you'll see from my first book, because Egypt, after the Suez Canal was built at the end of the 19th century, towards the end or the middle, people came from all over the old Ottoman lands and also from around the Mediterranean, because Egypt became the greatest new hub for commerce and for trade. And so a lot of the people who were giving me recipes were people who had come from around the Mediterranean and Ottoman lands. And so I had all these things. But I think I must have felt then how a recipe given by a person was important, that to know exactly how they cooked was important. And also the recipe had huge value. It had huge value because it had so much value to them. It was the most important thing that they could give me. So when I had become a food writer and I had to choose subjects about what to write or what to do, and at the time when my children left home, which I was still young in my 40s, not quite 50 yet, I decided that the day they leave, because the three of them left at the same time, I will leave as well. And I will travel the Mediterranean. And there I came to have a method of researching, because I went without any à l'aventure. I went not knowing what I would find, who I would meet. I did try starting always with some contacts, and some of my contacts were food writers, people that I had got to know through my work, or people that I heard of, you know, like in Italy, Massimo Alberini, who is a food historian. So I did try to get some contacts that were could help me. But when I went, I just decided that I won't waste a minute. I will ask every single person that I meet what is their favorite recipe. It was also a way for me as a woman, because it was nearly 40 years ago, more than 35 years ago, when it was unusual for women to travel alone. And people were suspicious of you. What are you doing here? I mean, a lot of people kept saying, where's your husband? You know, haven't you got any children? People would say. And so to have a reason to be there was very good. And so I'm an English food writer, and I've come to research your cuisine. And they didn't believe me when I said I was an English something, but they did believe I was interested in their cuisine. And everyone at that time was very, very glad to talk about food, because there wasn't all this interest in food at that time, where people are going everywhere to find recipes. In England, if I asked somebody, what is your favorite dish, he would think I was mad, because nobody talked about food. It was embarrassing when I said I'm a food writer. I would be at a party. And they wouldn't know what to say. They were looking around to see how can they move away. And
like it was such a low, lowly concern.
It was the lowest thing to be writing about food. And then the only question they could have would be, what kind of food? And in the very beginning, I would say Middle Eastern. And then people would really be embarrassed. And then, you know, like somebody said, is it going to be eyeballs and testicles? So there was no idea at all. And it was at the time that England was at war with NASA, and they had attacked and bombed. That was the Suez War. And so the idea of what the Egyptians eat was to many people disgusting. And it was also the colonies, the food of the colonies. You know, Arab food was considered the food of people in the desert. And
people we conquered.
Yeah. And so, but still, I kept thinking how important, that made me feel how important it was to understand not only a dish, but to explain it, to explain the culture, to be able to say what this dish is, what it represents. Why should I be putting it in a book for them to cook if they don't really want anything Egyptian or Arab or anything? But so, yes, I did. When I researched the Mediterranean, by the time I was in my late 40s and started traveling, I had a whole lot of questions to ask. Which region do you come from? Because I was interested in home cooking of the regions. At that time, when I started traveling, all the grand restaurants everywhere just had French cuisine in every Mediterranean country.
That's interesting.
You had any way to get the real cuisine, you only had home cooking. And that is what I was researching. But I was researching, let's say, in cities, and I would ask, which region are you from? And what did your parents do? And I wanted to place a dish to know the story, to know what is this dish? And I would ask them, do you know the history of your country and regards to food? And they had all kinds of myths and, you know, stories, legends about the dishes. But I waited until I got back home after each trip, and I started looking at the history. I would go to SOAS Library, that School of Oriental and African Studies, to University College Library, to the British Library and start reading the history of the country. And I was looking for how the food works or places in the story. And actually, it yeah. was like doing a puzzle, and every dish fitted in the puzzle.
Yeah.
Because why is this dish here? Who was here before? What happened here before? What kind of life did the peasants have? That's why this dish is the way it is.
Yeah. So you were mapping the history of migration of people and the history of the climate and the agricultural technology of a place. And then when you understand those things, you can start to see how the food came to be. Oh, if they were using this spice that had previously only existed over here, but you saw those people came, then that explains how that flavor got there.
Where they came from, the big migrations, but also what kind of peasantry was it? In Italy, it was peasants. Peasants were not feudal. I forget the name. There is an English name by which whole big families of peasants would rent or would live on the land of a landowner, for instance, who was in Turin or Milan. And they would work the land and give him half their produce to be able to be where they were.
Like sharecropping?
Yeah. And yes, exactly. And so what they cooked then, I wanted to know, because a lot of the dishes that are now very popular in Italy, for instance, they were dishes that developed in a particular area by families who were there and who did this because they grew all those things, because they had a pig and they would put little bits of ham everywhere. So it was those lives that, to me, I was trying to find out. And people would say at that time, when I was traveling, a lot of people in Italy, for instance, came from families of 10 children. Mm-hmm. And now they have one, maybe two, because it's expensive to have children. They want to give them a good life.
The industrial age, you're not living on the land.
But the dishes of the past have become still the foods that people love now.
Yeah. So the original story you told of collecting recipes from the different migrants who were coming to your family, that became your first book, a book of Middle Eastern food, which is really one of the great classics of culinary literature in English. And what you're also talking about, traveling, that was the method of that you use for your other books about the Mediterranean, about Italy, about Spain. Are there dishes you remember specifically from your travels that you just, you know, that just struck you? I mean, you're talking about these dishes in an intellectual way, and that's certainly what you're known for. But I know you love to cook.
Yeah.
I know you love the joy of cooking. And your new book is really much more about the pleasures of cooking and sharing than diving into like the historical context of dishes. So talk about dishes that you've had in your travels that really just sort of knocked you back and made you feel like, my God, this is where I am.
Yeah, there were hundreds. Because, you see, I did, I did go to Lebanon, I did go to Morocco, I did go and traveled around Morocco. And in Italy, I went to every single region when I did a book on Italian food. And in Spain, I went around all the regions. And yes, for me, the joy of a new dish is the most fantastic thing, to find a new dish and to eat it, and to eat it with people mm-hmm. that I'm fascinated by, in the joy of being, I don't know, in Marseille, for instance, at the beach, and somebody made a bouillabaisse, and then being in Spain, in Valencia, and on a field somebody is doing paella, and going to in Andalusia, staying there quite a bit at people's houses and going to a gastronomic festival, local gastronomic thing, and everybody had brought their dish and you bring the dishes there. And I had helped to make one dish with the person I was staying with. And then there are five old men who start playing their guitars and singing. And then people who come get up and start dancing by themselves. And then each person, any person from amongst the gastronomes goes and starts singing. And singing about the joys of the countryside and the joys and difficulties and sorrows. Of course, now it's all changed. Now it's immigrant workers who do the work. There isn't that old, but somehow that old life lives on in the recipes and it lives on in the music. And so for me, all those things, you know, going to Lebanon, for me, I felt it was wonderful to travel in Muslim countries as a Jew, just at the time when things were going wrong. And one of the Palestinian sheikh had just been assassinated by Israelis. And I was in Baalbek, which was the center of Hezbollah. His image was everywhere. Mm. I was there for a wedding. And then there were lots of people from Baalbek, you know. And instead, I was wondering, they all knew I had written a Jewish book. And but they were coming to me right away to ask me all about me. And, you know, how was it in Egypt when I was there? And I think the way food opens doors, the food is about bonding, is about welcoming. It's about when people, you're there as a guest, they will welcome you as open arms. But also, I must say, I've had, for instance, in Turkey, you know, from even 40 years ago, not quite for, yes, no, 40 years ago, I went there. And to think that right up till now, I have the same friends I made then. And I go and stay with them. They come and stay with me. One is the greatest food writer in Turkey. And
who is that?
Nevin Haliçi. But what I'm trying to say that I really wanted to be part. I loved really understanding, being part of the place, being intimate with the worlds. And that is what brought me the kind of love for doing what I do.
Yeah. It's about connecting with people, really.
Yeah. And it was this way because I think if you go as a tourist, it's a different thing. But when you're there and you want to connect and they really know that you are a person on your own, and I didn't ever come with as an institution or as an organization or with a crew of films. I just came as myself. Yeah. And so many people would just say, when I said, what is your favorite recipe? What is your... It was people sometimes I met on the train. And they'd say, well, come and have lunch now as we get off the train. Yes. Yeah. And I could do that.
That's amazing.
So for me, it was more interesting than going to the theater or the cinema to go in because I think in the kitchen, there's a rapport. You open yourself.
Yeah.
You don't, if they invite me and we sit in the living room, so they say, oh, yes, how are you? You know, how many children have you got? You know, and no, but when you're cooking, there's no formality. But also, I found that people open themselves to a stranger who comes right into the middle of their life, who isn't going to see them again, probably, and they can tell me their problems. And they did, you mm-hmm. know, because there you are, an yeah. innocent stranger who is there to listen as long as you give them a recipe.
We're talking to one of the true greats of English food writing, Claudia Roden. We'll be back with more with her in just a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with Claudia Roden, author of many groundbreaking books, including The Book of Jewish Food, and her newest, Claudia Roden's Mediterranean, Treasured Recipes from a Lifetime of Travel. Let's get back to my talk with her. You know, you noted when your first book came out, A Book of Middle Eastern Food in 1968, in the UK and in the English-speaking world, those cuisines were considered exotic,
yeah.
in you know, quotation marks. And, you know, people had crude ideas of what those cuisines were. And now we fast forward to today, and many of the flavors, many of the dishes are commonplace and or fetishized even. And I think there's a lot of complicated things we can talk about there, but knowing that you had such a role in that evolution, you know, I know that book is the Bible for many chefs I know. You know, the first thing they reach for is either that book or your updated versions or revisions over time. How does it feel? How do you think about that? It, you know, looking at the past 50 years or so and thinking about the evolution of the perception of Middle Eastern, Mediterranean cuisine in the English-speaking world, and how much you've influenced both home cooks and chefs.
It's very, very wonderful feeling. I think for a long time, I had no idea at all. And I think, you know, I became gradually aware when I saw magazines putting the recipes, and they used the same Jewish Egyptian spelling or something. I knew that mm-hmm. everything came from my book. And a lot of people like Jane Grigson, who wrote a column and recipes every week, she told me, I'm sorry, Claudia, I keep using your recipes and I keep acknowledging you. And the editor keeps taking it off, the acknowledgement, she said, because she thinks I'm doing it too much. But, you know, but I did realize it gradually. But I then started realizing that it was happening in restaurants. When I went, for instance, I went to Judge the Best restaurant in Australia. And I went from one region, from one state to another, and everybody had recipes. They didn't know I was going to be coming as the judge when they had them on their menu. But so many mm-hmm. things were. And so I just couldn't believe I'd go
I'd be
to Australia.
To cook for you,
and, you know, things like do'a, that I spelled duka. It is a seed, nut, and spice mixture of sesame seeds, hazelnuts, cumin, and coriander, and salt and pepper. And that is called do'a. But I wrote it in an ancient way, or rather literary way, duka, D-U-K-K-A-H. And that has become an industry in Australia, in England.
That's how the whole world spells
yes.
it.
Yes. And when I was in
because of you.
Egypt, I was invited to give seminars to the Chefs Association. And I asked them, what do you want me to speak about? And they said, what is Middle Eastern cuisine? What is Egyptian cuisine? What is the history of it? And what should we be cooking? And one of the things I said you should be cooking, you should be producing do'a, because the whole world is doing do'a. And they just laughed and laughed because they couldn't imagine there could be an industry of do'a, because I had spelt it dukkha. Somebody from Gourmet phoned and left a message on my machine when I was away. And he had gone to Egypt to look for dukkha, and he couldn't find it because he kept asking for dukkha, and nobody understood what he said. And it isn't something you buy. It's something that people make at home. And so there you are. And I feel now, I see Nigel Slater, you know, all the chefs here, they're throwing dukkha all over the place. So something was created.
I just edited a book with dukkha in it.
But I think one, I realized very much in America, when I was at Boston University, Rebecca Alcide at the time was inviting people to come and speak at the School of Gastronomy and Catering. And I went to speak about regional foods. And I realized it was full of chefs, of young chefs there. And one of the chefs there was Anna Sortoun. And she invited me.
Restaurant Oliana.
Exactly. And she had at the time maybe Casablanca or something. And she made a whole dinner, especially for me, in her restaurant. It was all a special event, inviting all the other chefs as well. And I was overcome with joy. But one of the chefs told me to explain, "You're a cook's food writer." Because she said, what happens is your books has made... has had such an influence that people are doing Middle Eastern, but they can't do traditional, authentic, because that is considered an ethnic restaurant. It's not valued as much as if they do their own original recipes, if they are inventive.
Spin out, yeah.
And she said, what happens is, Anna or somebody else does then a take on your book in their restaurant. Then they get an award, they write a book, and a new generation of chefs use her book as inspiration to do their own take on Middle Eastern or Italian or Mediterranean. And then it becomes the take of the take of the take. And she said, we can go back to you to see what was the original. And now the Middle Eastern recipes now have taken off a life of their own. The Middle Eastern recipes of today, as you said, they are fantastical and also fantastic. So sometimes, nearly mostly.
Sure. And actually that brings me to your newest book, Claudia Roden's Mediterranean, and in it you certainly have some dishes that you've gathered from your travels, some of your favorites, and some dishes that are not traditional at all. It seems dishes that you have that are your takes, as you said before, the takes on the takes on the takes. Some of these are your takes. What's a recipe that you love from this book that you didn't find anywhere, but sort of came together in your kitchen?
No, I am afraid I'm not like those totally inventive chefs who are absolutely cutting edge invention. For me, I still have a deep love of tradition, but I do it in my way.
What are some favorite dishes that you rediscovered along the way?
I think, you know, there's, for instance, now you ingredients we couldn't find, like frike. Frike is this grain, wheat, that in Egypt we called ferik. We used to use it, but now there's a sophisticated dish with chicken, in fact, it's a Palestinian dish.
Well, frike, this is the wheat.
Yeah.
Sorry, the grain is the wheat that's burned on the stalk, right? So there's a smoky flavor in it.
It's a young grain, that is green mm-hmm. wheat, you call it, but it's young and moist, and they burn the wheat, and so the mm-hmm. chaff burns away, and then they sort of rub the wheat, and so it is this young wheat, and it takes a while to cook. Sometimes some of the wheat, the ferrique we get is cracked.
Okay.
So it cooks quicker. I do things that cook quick because of my strength. And I do have in lockdown, my children came and they sat in the garden and I brought out the food. And so I kept on cooking to retest things. And there were pastas, there were polentas. Polenta with different things to what they use traditionally to put on them. And I like the way of using grains and vegetables together, so it makes one dish. I did a lot of couscous and couscous with fish. And I love doing fish soups because there's potatoes inside, there's the fish. It's a marvelous one-meal dish. But I must say I don't do one dish meal.
Yeah.
I do many things because I keep wanting to keep trying other things.
Yeah.
So out of hundreds of dishes, I did choose these.
I mean, a lifetime of cooking and 18 cookbooks later, you have, I'm sure, literally thousands of recipes to choose from.
Yes. But I think I'm really now thinking of what do I want to eat rather than what did I find?
Mm-hmm.
What was memorable? What do I want to eat? And I know that for my puddings, I chose mainly fruit puddings because that's what I want mostly.
Yeah.
And I've got hundreds more vegetarian dishes because many of my grandchildren's friends are vegetarian and they come with them
yeah.
a couple at a time. And they say, so-and-so is vegetarian, so-and-so is vegan, so-and-so is gluten-free.
Yeah.
So I've been trying, thinking of them and what I like
yeah.
and what is easiest for me to cook. I think unlike the chefs who really can put all their efforts and energy to come up with the one magnificent dish that can have many parts to it. I feel my strength limits my dish to a simplicity that I'm happy with
yeah.
and which also my readers would be happy with.
Sure.
Because we're not chefs.
Yeah. Well, Claudia, after a lifetime of listening to others and their stories and their recipes, it's nice for you to have time to just listen to yourself and what you want. This has been such an honor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure and my honor.
Claudia Roden's first book was A Book of Middle Eastern Food, and her latest is called Claudia Roden's Mediterranean: Treasured Recipes from a Lifetime of Travel. And for a collection of her recipes, check them out at splendidtable.org. You know, I think so much about how Claudia described writing her first book. You know, how it was really an act of longing, right? Of missing and trying to reconstruct the tastes of home. And how that home was lost to her and her friends and family. But I think about, you know, how out of that pain, that deep pain, what she made was such a gift to the world. How someone for the first time in literally centuries put in English those recipes to paper and introduced so many people to those foods. It's incredible. Thank you, Claudia. That's our show for this week. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lubke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.